This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The city of Valparaiso has changed for the better, even during a pandemic. Rex Richards is the president of the Valparaiso Chamber of Commerce, and we talked with him in his office on Friday.
Rex, if you will, fill us in first off on how things are going right now as far as businesses and industries in the city of Valparaiso.
Well, we've found that actually overall business is pretty strong in Valpo. One of the great things about our community is we do not have one overriding major employer that when the economy maybe goes down, that they suffer. We are a very diversified community. We have a number of professional businesses. We have a number of small manufacturing companies that have been very, very successful. And therefore, a lot of our businesses are what I call niche businesses, and they are not as susceptible to the downturns in the economy. So therefore, our economy over the last 2 years has really continued to beat at a very strong magnitude.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of impact did the coronavirus pandemic have when the virus really started to spread?
Well, of course, a number of companies, if they were had to go and their people were working remotely. Mm-hmm. And of course the restaurants were hurt extremely bad because that affected people going out for dinner. And of course in Valparaiso, one of our real strengths is our really outstanding downtown. And our downtown has been rebuilt as a dining destination facility. We have a number of really fantastic restaurants that draw people from all over Northwest Indiana and Southwest Michigan to come and dine here. So the restaurant industry was impacted for probably a good year, but things are on the uptick. And people, if you drive to Valparaiso in the evenings from like Tuesday through Sunday, you cannot find a parking spot on Lincoln Way because the number of restaurants that we have are back going in pretty good swing. Now, you know, everyone is looking for help, but, you know, a lot of our restaurants have been very, very successful in maintaining that momentum.
Do you know if many of them had an opportunity or if not had the opportunity, took the opportunity, if it was available, to use the federal relief money that was coming in to help keep their staff going, keep their businesses open?
Absolutely. Our local community banks have been real great partners with their business customers. I happen to have the opportunity to be chairman of the SBA 504 lending program for 2 years. And I saw firsthand how the local banks were helping local businesses with those, what we call PPP loans. And that was a tremendous incentive to help local small businesses continue to survive.
Were there any other businesses, and I'm thinking more of like industries that got hit especially hard, at least at first, and are trying to recoil from the pandemic in getting their operations up and running again?
Well, again, I go back to my original suggestion that a lot of our manufacturing businesses are in what I call real niche markets.
Right.
And fortunately, there's always a couple that were hurt. But by and large, most of our manufacturing companies have continued to produce, and they've been very cautious and making sure that their employees try to stay healthy so they can get their products out. But overall, things have gone pretty well in Valparaiso.
That's good. Now, taking a look at today, how are some of the industries doing? Are they, since they've been able to bounce back or stay open because of the pandemic's impact, are you seeing that they're getting more orders and in turn they're looking to expansion, or there are some other businesses looking to come into Valparaiso to expand operations?
Well, the last question you just mentioned, We have found that 2021 has been a real banner year for new operations to come to Valparaiso. Early on in 2021, we were able to locate an Amazon distribution facility to Valparaiso, Indiana. They purchased an 80,000 square foot industrial shell building and have made huge investment in that. They acquired an additional 13 acres, I believe, and are working real hard to get to a point where they will start delivering product out of that Amazon facility probably before the end of the year. So that's been a real boon, and they're going to be employing 300 people. We're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of a $30 to $40 million investment in Valparaiso, Indiana. We've also had another company out of Chicago that has acquired acreage, and they have plans to build a 100,000 square foot manufacturing plant, and they will be employing somewhere about 100 to 150 people. So 2021 was a, you know, really turned out to be, from a business attraction standpoint, a tremendous year for us. And of course, when you have someone such as an Amazon locate in your community, that really brings up, gets attention from other companies that want to look at a location where Amazon located.
Okay. Would you say that with those two examples that you mentioned of businesses coming in, getting set up, or in operation already, what seems to be, if there is a few things that's on the list, and then maybe you do this when you do pitches with companies, to be able to let people know why Valparaiso is so attractive to businesses coming in and factories for that matter too?
Well, first and foremost, you have to have ideally an available building, because if you have an existing building, that cuts the time it takes from the standpoint of when the company acquires the building, gets it ready, and then they can start producing product out of that facility. It's a matter of time. So we did have a facility. We've got two additional facilities that are available for people to look at. They're nice industrial buildings, so we're getting a lot of people, particularly from Chicago, companies coming who might want to make expansions outside of the city of Chicago.
Okay. Would you say that those have been some of the key things that have attracted not only businesses but more people into Valparaiso?
Well, what my belief is, and talking with the companies that are looking at Valparaiso, it's really about our quality of life. It's about having great neighborhoods where their employees can live. It's to have housing opportunities. And of course, people coming in from outside of the city, particularly if they're coming from Illinois, the values and what they can buy for their dollar is so much greater in Valparaiso as opposed to where they have been living in Illinois. And so we have a fantastic school system in Valparaiso that's recognized as one of the best in the state. And people want to live where there is a really great school system. So we have a wonderful park department with a lot of places that people can go and enjoy being outside. It really boils down to having a good quality of life. And in Northwest Indiana, I'll give you my impression, of course. I am president of the Chamber of Commerce, always trying to promote the community. But we have, if not the best, one of the best communities in Northwest Indiana to live and raise a family.
Rex Richards is the president of the Valparaiso Chamber of Commerce. And Rex, thank you for sharing your thoughts and filling us in on how the city of Valparaiso is doing from the business and industry side.
Thank you very much.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Daniel Keenahan is executive director of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Insurance Service. Never heard of that before? Well, a lot of people have not, even if you've been in the service before. And once you got out, you, of course, may have had some kind of service-related life insurance while you were on active duty, but you have that available as well. And Mr. Kinahan will tell us more about it. Thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Chris, thanks so much for having me.
Will you first explain how did the VA get involved in life insurance, and how is it that the VA, rather than the U.S. Department of Defense, provides it?
So the VA has been involved in providing insurance for over 100 years. We started during World War I with the War Risk Insurance Program, and as different conflicts have continued, we've been able to evolve and increase the amounts and benefits available to service members and to veterans.
Mm-hmm.
We cover the whole life cycle of a service member from the day when they first enlist or sign up through their transition out of uniform service to becoming a veteran, and then again when the veteran goes to the VA and gets a VA rating for a service-connected disability.
What seem to be the differences, if there are very many, between VA insurance and what can be offered by a private insurance company?
So VA Insurance Service offers both term and whole life insurance, which you can find in the private sector. However, we cover some things that the private sector might not, like service-connected disabilities related to uniform service, as well as war risk insurance, which covers while a uniform service member is actively serving.
Mm-hmm. Does the VA require service members to have a medical exam before they can make the changeover from their one service-related coverage they had while they were still on active duty into the Veterans Group life insurance plans?
Service members can convert their existing SGLI coverage to VGLI coverage as long as they apply within 1 year and 120 days from when they separate.
Mm-hmm.
I encourage service members to do that up to 240 days prior to them separating so that they don't have to do any medical screening. Once a veteran receives a service rating from the VA separately, they can apply for either our existing service-disabled veterans insurance or a new VA life insurance program we're about to roll out in January of 2023.
Is this something that perhaps that the veteran or about to be a veteran learns when they get their separation or discharge from the service? Do they get told about this at the time, or is this something that maybe not many veterans really know about?
So veterans have a lot of information coming to them when they're separating from service,
uh-huh.
And we're trying to do more outreach with our partners in the VA as well as different military services and through partners like you.
Can spouses and can family members be covered on these VA life insurance policies?
Spouses and family members are eligible for coverage through Family Service Members Group Life Insurance while the member is in uniform. And then those coverage amounts can be converted to a private sector firm without medical underwriting at the time of separation through partnerships that we have.
I know that your office is going through some very serious modernization work. It's underway. What has the VA done to modernize the life insurance benefits and services?
We're doing a lot to automate and meet our veterans where they want to be able to access it. A lot of that includes online document upload or accessing policies. We've recently automated our instant loan approval process for veterans who have existing policies with cash values. We're doing more with a partnership through the Department of the Treasury for online bill pay. And then we also are getting ready to launch a new program where the application will be entirely done online and go into effect January 1st of 2023.
Now that you've been working on the modernizing the existing programs, are there any new life insurance programs for veterans now?
Yes, this VA life insurance program is going to come into effect in January of 2023.
Mm-hmm.
There's not going to be time limits to sign up as long as the veteran is aged 80 or under, and we're looking forward to being able to be responsive to what they're looking to meet their needs. Everybody's got different stories, but it's tremendous when beneficiaries reach out and they let us know that through this benefit, they're able to honor their veteran in a way that's commensurate with their service. It's able to help the family who might be going through difficult times or meet other end-of-life costs that might exist in order to close things out for that veteran.
Now, we talked an awful lot here about the number of life insurance protection offered by the VA. If anyone is interested, maybe they've forgotten some of the information they got when they were mustered out, so to speak, or they were separated from active duty, and they're now veterans. Where can they find out more about the life insurance programs VA offers?
I'd recommend everybody go to va.gov/life-insurance to learn more, or call our insurance service center at 1-800-669-8477.
Daniel Keenahan is the Executive Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs Insurance Service. Hope that this gets word out to people that maybe have forgotten, I'm sure in many cases, that there's still life insurance benefits that are available to them, even though that they're no longer on active duty. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me and for supporting our veterans.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's a reminder that the 10-digit mandatory dialing takes effect 1 month from now. To find out more about it, let's talk with Anthony Swinger. He is with the Indiana Utility Consumer Counselor's Office in Indianapolis. And Anthony, thanks for joining us on the program today.
It's good to be with you again, Chris. Thanks.
Well, yeah, we got together about a month ago to tell everybody that there's going to be some big changes in dialing here in Northwest Indiana, in particular in not only the area code 219, but the 574 area codes. Will you bring us up to date first as to why there are the big changes and how things are coming along as people try to get used to the changes that will be happening soon?
I certainly can, Chris. What is happening is that next year, people who need to call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline will be able to reach the lifeline by calling a simple three-digit code, 988. Now, in order for that to work, there are a number of area codes around the country that need to change their dialing patterns. There are a lot of area codes around the U.S., including the area codes in central and southern Indiana, and most area codes in the Chicago area, which have already converted to 10-digit dialing. And they did that because of the need to add more telephone numbers to those area codes. And when we talk about 10-digit dialing, we're talking about including the area code at the beginning of a local call. Up to this point, the 219 and 574 area codes, as well as 708, have been using 7-digit dialing. But they are among about 80 area codes in the country that still use 7-digit dialing and have a 988 prefix that's being used. And so if you're going to make the 988 code available to everyone across the country, and you still have 988 in use of some prefixes, then there needs to be a way to get through to those numbers and keep the 988 code as accessible as possible. So that's why this change is happening.
It sounds like at least here in Indiana, with the two area codes that are affected, including ours, is that at least it's only a matter of maybe changing to 10-digit dialing rather than being unfortunate enough to live in an area code that in turn would have to completely be changed then.
Right, and what's happening in all 80 or so of these area codes throughout the U.S. is that they're all making this change and this upgrade on the same timeline. A six-month grace period is still in effect where you can make a local call either with 7 or 10 digits.
Mm-hmm.
Beginning October 24th, if you try to make a local call without the area code, you'll get a recording asking you to try again and include the area code with the number. So this is a coordinated effort. It's happening nationwide. And it's also important to keep in mind that the changes that are happening here will not affect your rates. They will not change the billing amounts you pay for telephone service, nor do they change how you call 911, 811, and other three-digit numbers that we've all been used to using for so long.
Will it affect local calls as far as we know?
The only impact is that you need to dial the area code at the beginning of the call. It does not turn a local call into a long-distance call. It's just a different way of reaching the same local number. And again, it's to pave the way for 988 to be used as the suicide prevention lifeline code nationwide.
Now, you mentioned the fact that we're not going to see any impact on 911 if you have to make an emergency call. How about the other three-digit numbers that exist right now? Will they be changed at all?
No changes at all. just as you can now. If you need to have your property marked for utility locates before you dig, 811 will still work the way it does now.
Mm-hmm.
The 211 number for social services, it will still function the same as it does now after the transition. And the same, of course, goes for 911. The only thing that's going to change is the need to include the area code at the beginning of a local call. And in many cases, folks are already doing 10-digit dialing, even if they may not realize it, with cell phones and smartphones having the technology that they have now.
Now, how about safety and security equipment, like people that have medical alert devices, alarm systems, and things like that? What kind of changes would have to be made now, and they only have a month yet to do?
If you have an alarm system or if you use a medical alert device, it is a good idea to check with your service provider and make sure that it's ready for mandatory 10-digit local dialing. In a lot of these cases, the calls are already directed to toll-free numbers or numbers that are already long distance, and so they're not going to be affected by this. But if it's a local service or it goes to a local number, contacting your provider, making sure that they're ready to go with 10-digit dialing is a good idea.
Now, have you folks with the Office of Utility Consumer Counselor in Indianapolis gotten many calls, requests, or questions that have come in since the first word went out here about a month ago, trying to get people acquainted to the changes so they're not going to be caught unaware next month?
We really haven't, Chris, and I think that's reflective of the fact that this is not as difficult a transition as it might have been a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you'll remember about 20 years ago when 219 spanned the entire northern third of the state and was broken up with 574 and 260 being added. That was a big transition for many, many people because they had to change their phone numbers, and they had to let everyone they knew know that, you know, you need to call 574 to reach South Bend instead of 219. The changes here are not as dramatic as that, and I think that's reflected in the fact that we've heard from fewer people about this one.
So I suppose if you do have to make changes in particular for your marketing purposes, you have to change maybe your website or your stationery, advertising materials and things like that to make sure that you've got the full 10-digit numbers on that material, right?
Right. That is one thing that comes into play. Fortunately, many businesses have already gone to that and used the area codes. I think the fact that we have 10-digit dialing in effect already in so much of the country has helped with that transition. As I mentioned earlier, all of the Chicago area codes except 708 have already gone to 10-digit dialing, and Indianapolis and southern Indiana went to 10-digit dialing 5-6 years ago.
Well, it looks like at least with most cases, we're about ready to make the change. And in fact, if you've been putting in the 1219 so far and whatever numbers you call out, then you're already set to go when the official change takes place in October. Anthony, thank you for spending time with us to talk about it today.
Great talking with you as always.
Thank you very much. Anthony Swinger is the spokesperson for the Indiana Office of Utility Consumer Counselor. Parks are essential for the quality of life, but what if a community park doesn't serve its people? Side Effects Public Media's Farah Yousri goes into one Indianapolis neighborhood to take a look at Tarkington Park in more detail and the people who live around it.
Tarkington Park on 39th and Illinois Street has been a go-to destination for the black community for decades, like Sabay Martin, who's 63. She stands next to a basketball court and talks about her favorite memory here.
Saying I'm coming to the park, and my mom saying, don't you go down there by those basketball courts. And as a, you know, preteen, teenager, you know, just to get close enough to see all the cute boys.
But the park looked and felt different back then. And it's not just the park.
There used to be a grocery store there.
She points to a few abandoned shops.
Where are the replacements? And why is it taking so long?
For her and many others, this place symbolizes the inequity that engulfs Indianapolis. It's at the intersection of two very different lives, and it has one of the lowest life expectancies in the city, nearly 11 years less than a neighborhood that's only a 10-minute drive away.
Nice, 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 nice. Now go, now get out. Good.
You know, this is like the central meeting area between all of the neighborhoods.
That's Coach Donald Hamilton, or Coach Snell. He trains the Indy Steelers, a youth football team for more than 100 kids between ages 5 and 14. It's one of the few outlets for youth around here. They trained on a big green field at Tarkenton Park, 3 days a week for more than 15 years. Children would show up for practice wearing their protective helmets, and Coach Snell would set up obstacles and training gear.
Go get some water. Hey, the bottles are right here.
But then on a Labor Day weekend in 2015, something unexpected happened.
We were showing up for practice one day, and we came up to the park, and we were fenced off of the field, like we couldn't go anywhere.
Coach Snell and his team had no idea what was going on in the park. And it turns out hundreds of residents here didn't know either. And it all started with the best intentions back in 2012. The city wanted to give the park a little facelift, a splash pad, climbing wall, and a community cafe. The fence walled off the park so that renovations could begin.
I'm Michael McKillop, Executive Director of Midtown Indy.
McKillop was one of the people tasked by the city to plan the renovations. He met with many in the black community, and things were going well. Or at least that's what he thought.
In my mind, it was like, wow, we have several hundred people weighed in. And, you know, public participation in shaping the future of city stuff rarely happens.
But the image of kids fenced off from their park was such a throwback to times when black Americans were not allowed in many public spaces. And that sparked outrage in much of the black community here.
And I think the protests showed me that this was a very deep problem. You know, this wasn't one or two people with an axe to grind. This was a whole community that felt left out, and that's a problem.
McKillop wanted to do the right thing. He engaged with many, but maybe not all the right people. Because of multiple jobs and kids, many local residents couldn't show up for these planning meetings and lacked computer and internet access to weigh in. Systemic barriers that spill over even when it comes to having a say in their own community park. The renovations were completed in 2016, and there's no denying the park is fancier and prettier now. And it's also bustling with more white families than before, something many in the black community don't mind. But others, like Sarita Edwards, a 40-year-old mother, says it has raised questions.
So I remember my son even asking me, like, is it because the park is new? I said, well, you know, anything that's new attracts new people, you know, like, so, but these people,
like, it's new, so, like, it's for them,
in a sense,
they don't get new things,
in a sense.
Kids may not be thinking about larger issues around racism and politics, but Edward says they pick up on daily cues from the environment around them. For instance, after the renovations, the Indy Steelers now are stuck with a field full of small hills and dirt. Here's Coach Snell.
Yeah, kind of confined to a smaller area, which is okay. I mean, we make do with what we have. But
making do with what's there is what many in the black community say they've been pushed to do for a long time. And it often comes at a price. In this case, a physical one. Many twisted ankles and other injuries on the bumpy field. Still, things are getting better around Tarkenton Park in many ways. The cafe at the park is now a black-owned business. There are many community festivals happening. Here's Sabi Martin again.
The best day we had in the park was Tarkenton Park Fest. The splash pad was full of kids. We had music, the coming together of the neighborhood with basketball tournaments.
Constructive dialogue was born out of the conflict over the park. Now the community hopes the same could address other issues that impact life expectancy around here, like the lack of access to food, subpar public education, and ultimately, a decent, safe training field for the Indy Steelers.
Let's go, don't be less! Don't be less!
Farah Yusri, Side Effects Public Media.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll talk with Bill Wozniak, who is with InvestEd, about the ability to access millions of dollars in free state financial aid to help pay for post-secondary education, whichever it may be, college or other type of schooling, and the help that the organization can make to help people in Indiana sign up. Hope you can join us tomorrow.